Dette et opptak fra Civita kveld 14. i tredje med Ivan Krastev. Det publikum til stede, så dette altså en livesending dere nå får høre.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to this Civita meeting, which is also recorded for the podcast Liberal Halvtime. My name is Mathilde Fasting, and we have invited Ivan Krastev, and he is the chairman of the Center for Liberal Strategies and a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. Krastev has written many books, including The Light That Failed with Stephen Holmes in 2018. And he is a contributor to New York Times and Financial Times, and as we agreed on, lots of other things that we don't need to mention here. Welcome, Ivan.
Thank you very much.
We will do this conversation first, as I told you, a podcast that you might may listen to later on. But when we finish that, it will be open for Q&As. And we'll have to finish sharp 7:10. So I'll see to it that we stay within that time limit. Start with a question to you, because you mentioned something beforehand about something you called it broken mirrors. And what do you mean by saying that the international order now is a hall of broken mirrors?
Thank you very much. First, very happy to be here. The fact that you have beer makes kind of me more relaxed. Because if you're not going to enjoy the talk, at least you can enjoy the beer. But secondly, listen, like everybody these days, you're trying to make sense of what is going on. And this is a radical change. We can interpret it in one way or the other. And one of the things that, for me at least, was very important was that, well, many people are saying we're going back where we were. This is kind of a return of the Cold War. We're back to the kind of ideological divide. I see something slightly different. I see very much the rise of the identity politics on the level of international politics. We have seen this as the rise on the national politics in many places, but in a certain way, what I see there is not a kind of a classical ideological politics focus on the future, which you know from the Cold War. You have something different, basically. The fact that President Putin believes that Ukrainians are Russians, it's not an ideology. And I'm saying this because this creates a very specific problem. I could be wrong, but I do believe one of the reasons the Cold War was a much more peaceful period than many feared in the late 1940s and early 50s, particularly when it comes to the direct clash between the West and Soviet Union, was that both sides believed that time is on their side. Soviets believe, because they have been reading carefully Marx, that future is on their side. So why to clash now if tomorrow I'm going to be in a stronger position? And the same was for the West, basically. As Kennan famously said in the 1947-49, he basically said the most important for the American strategy is to outweigh the Soviets. They have the internal contradictions in the system, which is going to do it. Now we're in a much more difficult moment because identity politics is not about the future, it's about the past. And secondly, you have the feeling that time is not on your side. If I'm not going to do something now, probably is going to be much more difficult to do it tomorrow. And this is why, for us, this idea of broken mirrors, in which basically the essence of politics is to force others to view you in the way you're viewing yourself. And as you know, this is not easy.
But you mean that international politics will become much more difficult than because of this?
Yeah. I do believe that the level of tension is high. By the way, the level of tension was also very high in the different periods of the Cold War. One of the interesting stories of the Cold War is that when it was over, people started to remember it was kind of a nostalgic period where everything was fine, but it was not true. It was not true, of course, in the eastern part, but also it was not true if you go back to the crisis of the 1950s, or basically if you go to what was happening in 1961 around Berlin and others, you had the feeling that the war is just going to happen tomorrow. So from this point of view, part of the story is that in our lifetime, what we remember of the Cold War was the last decade. And this was not the most important decade. And even basically, if you're living in certain parts, for example, in Poland in 1980, 1981, you're not going to remember it this way. But then you have this kind of a structured conflict in which basically the two political blocs were very much totally isolated when it comes to economy, when it comes to security, when it comes basically to running it. Now, interesting story is that we're living in the world in which the countries with which you trade are not necessarily the countries which is going to be your security partner. And also some of the major ideological divides are not working in the way they have been working before. Let's give you one example. Majority of the countries that President Biden invited for the Summit of Democracies do not sanction Russia. Some of the big democratic countries like Brazil, like India, Turkey, NATO member is not sanctioning. So from this point of view, this type of a thing cannot happen so easily during the Cold War. It was a different type of divide. And this is why when it comes to identity politics, the logic is different, the mobilization is different, and this is something that, in my view, this type of a difference is something to be taken seriously. Plus, and this is my last point, even during the Cold War, particularly in the 70s, the post-colonial sentiment was very much there in the Third World. But of course, many of these countries are much more powerful, much more bigger, and economically much more relevant than they have been 30 or 50 years ago. So this type of a totally different sensibility is what you see.
Also in your book that I mentioned, The Light That Failed, you describe culture. And if I bring up another article, we talked about an article from 1989, but I'm bringing up an article from 1993, A Clash of Civilizations by Samuel Huntington. It's 30 years today or this year. Can you describe a bit those different identities that we are now talking about? And in the view of Huntington's civilizations, which also contains culture and identity in it, and religion, of course.
Thank you very much. It's a great question, because in a certain way, there is one thing. When it comes to book publishing, Fukuyama's The End of History was a bestseller in the West and nowhere else, Huntington's The Clash of Civilization was a major bestseller in places like Russia, China, India. And this is interesting because the book was based on an article which Huntington published first in the Foreign Affairs. And it was interesting, the reason, the project in which the article was produced. Basically, Huntington, who is, by the way, extremely interesting political scientist, not simply on the fact that he's a good political scientist, but he had an intuition of the problem that is going to emerge. For example, he had a famous book from the 1960s about the changing political order. He was one of the first who basically managed after that in his last book to hint to the importance of demography in the American domestic politics.
Who are we?
Who are we? Yeah. But what is interesting about this book is he wrote a book trying to answer the question, it was a Pentagon-supported project, what are the areas in which the Americans should interfere? It was 1993. It was very much about Bosnia. Don't forget, should Americans be involved or not involved? Back then, it was a very much a debated issue. And he said, you should interfere only in your civilizational sphere of influence. But for him, civilization was very much based on religion. From this point of view, the war between Russia and Ukraine is not a Huntingtonian war, because for him, Russia and Ukraine were part of the same civilization, because he was thinking in Orthodox religion. And secondly, of course, he believes that identities are very, very strong and stable. What I do believe at the same time, basically the same year, another book was published, which much fewer people have been rereading, because it was not written by a political scientist, but a very famous kind of a German poet and public intellectual, and it was Hans Magnus Enzensberger. And the book is called Civil War. And by the way, if you have time, reread the book. It's an amazing book. So in 1993, he said, what is coming after the end of the Cold War is a period of a civil wars. What is important for these civil wars, they're molecular, and he put together the Rice Riots in LA from this period, the Bosnia War, what was happening in Africa. And he said, the most important is that you have a violence which does not need ideology anymore. And he was giving an example of this type of a new type of a civil war where you cannot easily make a distinction between destruction and self-destruction. The story of one of the armed groups during the African conflict who went into the hospital in the region and destroyed the Higgs ray apparatus. And this was the only one in the country. So he said, if these people are going to have a problem, these same people are never going to have a possibility, anybody, to treat them. But the most important is that the violence itself was the message. And he was saying this because this is important. If you start to compare the Cold War period and the post-Cold War period, you're going to see that in the post-Cold War period, we have a quite few war between states. What we see, Russia-Ukraine is a classic war between states. But at the same time, the number of the civil wars increased, and basically the number of people that have died in the post-Cold War period are not much less than during the Cold War period, but simply because it was very much based on this kind of civil wars, we were much more aware of what was happening. So this is why Huntington's idea was based that we know who we are, and this is why we're fighting. Our major argument with Stephen Holmes is that we are not sure who we are anymore. And this is why we're fighting. And I'm going to repeat something that they said yesterday. And to be honest, repeating yourself is even worse than aging. And doing it in a 48-hour period, it's really painful. But just to understand where I'm coming. And I had a huge kind of... my idea is to understand something, you should basically start from what you find the most strange in a conflict. And the most strange about this conflict is the mass kidnapping of the Ukrainian children. First, this is big. The biggest what I have seen is 300,000 people, but for sure we're talking about more than 100,000. So the scale is very important. So it started from the very first day of the war, when it still was a special operation. And secondly, the moment it started, the Russian Duma voted a legislation that make it very easy and very fast for Russian families to adopt Ukrainian children. And the story is why, where it comes from. And I'm saying this because I believe very few people are going to understand what is going on if they don't understand a major demographic obsession of President Putin with the shrinking of the Russian population. Russia, like many other societies, basically, Bulgaria is. And yeah, we Bulgarians know something about shrinking population. Basically, but Russia was losing, of course, population. And yesterday I was talking to a colleague because President Putin was quoting several times in the months going to the war, one and the same phrase, that according to the famous Russian scientists of the 19th century, Mendeleev, in year 2000, they should have been 500 million Russians in the world, and now they're only 150 million. And he was blaming the wars, the revolution, and so on for what happened. It turned out, as I learned, that basically Mendeleev was the 17 children in his family, the youngest one. So the idea of Russia, and this is very important, Russia was always famous for having more soldiers than guns. And this is not a metaphor, by the way. This was during the World War I, the famous Brusilov attacks and so on. You have really more soldiers than guns. And now, for the first time, basically, one of the major problems also the Russian army was facing in Ukraine when the war started was the lack of people. And this obsession of a shrinking population was, we don't have Russians enough, so Ukrainians should be Russians. And if the Ukrainians does not want to be Russians, if they basically, for reasons that probably they're going to explain through the Western propaganda, believe that there's something else, we're not going to allow them to socialize our children. Because this is our children. And I do believe this is critically important also to understand part of the tensions, and it comes also in a situation in which, not simply on the level of the nations, but also on the level of personal identities, these days, to a certain extent, who you are is very much your choice. Listen, people are coming from different places. All of us, basically, we have here several Bulgarians in the room, at least, which I see. And then comes basically the children of all these families who they are. We don't know. In a certain way, they decide for themselves who they are. And from this point of view, this is different than Huntington. Huntington believed that we know this is there, this is the clash. While we have this very unstable identity, you have the fear that somebody can turn you or your kids in somebody else, and this is why we need the war, and this war should consolidate these identities. And I do believe from this point of view, it's different than the way Samuel Huntington was seeing this.
We can follow up a little bit on Huntington because I reviewed the book some weeks ago and I saw that he had a very interesting map. And the map explained Russia and Ukraine. And he had a whole chapter where he drew a line straight north-south through Ukraine saying that this part was belonging to Russia and the other part was belonging to the West in his terms of civilizations. Yeah. And he also kind of prophetically said that probably one of the alternatives for Russia is to invade the eastern part of Ukraine and taking them back into Russia. So what are we seeing now in... you explained some reasons why they're doing this, but actually what Huntington saw was that Ukrainians were not one people. They were separated into two different zones, so to say. Do you think that what's happening now in Ukraine, obviously there are more Ukrainians all over the place now, not this dividing line, but how has this come into play with Russia now and with the Ukrainians? Is it true what he said or not?
Listen, for sure, by the way, you have, of course, much more Russian-speaking population in the eastern part of Ukraine. And when you see the voting behaviors, particularly before Maidan, you're going to see that Eastern Ukraine was much more voting for the party of the regions and Western Ukraine much more were voting basically for the pro-Western parties. But why I'm going to say that it is slightly more complicated. I was in 1998 for the first time and the last time in my life in Lugansk. And I don't know how is Lugansk before it was basically destroyed by war. But going to Lugansk in 1998 and before it I was in Kiev, I was in Moscow, you don't have the feeling that you're going from Ukraine to Russia or from Russia to Ukraine. You have the feeling that you're in the Soviet Union. Hmm. It was a very Soviet place. And it was a very Soviet place, not in this kind of political terms and so on, but their identity. Don't forget that Donbas was the place which was very much created due to the industrialization. So there were people from everywhere coming. So you cannot say that there was these people staying there forever for centuries, what basically Huntington assumes, because of the mining and the coal industry. Basically, in the 1920s and 1930s, most of the Russian, Ukrainian, or Kazakh peasants, if you try basically to go somewhere, you're going to Donbas. And these people had a very strange identity. By the way, they were speaking Russian. This was also their version of Russian. But also what was interesting is that they were not unhappy with having the Ukrainian passports, but their identity was post-Soviet. One of the things that really happened with the war is that you cannot be post-Soviet anymore. You're either Russian or Ukrainian. There is no choice anymore. In a certain way, by the way, this happened absolutely the same in Bosnia in 94, 95. 70% of Bosnians were defining themselves as Yugoslavs back then. There was a lot of mixed marriages. But listen, when the war started, you decide on which side of the front you are. And this kind of a destruction of the hybrid identity is very much there. The second thing that happened and which was critically important for the change of Ukraine is the biggest problem was about Kyiv. Kyiv was a Russian-speaking city, but day by day for the last 30 years, exactly because it was the capital of Ukraine, people living in Kyiv developed much more the Ukrainian identity. And of course, from this point of view, Maidan was critically important. And from this point of view, Crimea was critically important. Of course, it's absolutely true if there is a place where there was a people with a Russian identity. Are they minority or majority? I'm not going to count them, but it was Crimea, for sure. This was the Russian fleet there. But just to tell you how much we should look back to Crimea to understand what happened after that in 2022. Listen, when basically the annexation started, there were 20,000 Ukrainian troops stationed in Crimea, and none of them fought back. this was a very much also the result of the demoralization of power that came with Yanukovych. But the anecdote, which if you don't know, you're going to remember, is the following. Of all Ukrainian ships that have been around Sevastopol, all surrendered to the Russian fleet, which was, of course, much stronger, only one did not surrender. So the Russians surrounded and said, we are going to destroy you, surrender. And the captain of the ship said, we Russians do not surrender. I'm telling you in order to understand the level of confusion, but also the level of the humiliation that basically Ukrainians experienced facing the fact that back then, these 20,000 Ukrainian soldiers didn't defend the land. And as a result of it, when the war started this time, you have just the opposite type of reaction. Everybody has heard about the famous Snake Island, where basically the Ukrainian troops said to the Russian forces, go and fuck yourself. The story is the following. From strategic point of view, defending Snake Island does not make sense, and they cannot defend it. It was a very small military unit, which basically is facing a totally, totally prevailing army. But this was this idea of a kind of a not strategically motivated heroism, but this is what builds identity. And I'm saying this because one of the most interesting thing about this war is that, as you know, the Russian government is trying to frame it as the continuation of the World War II, where the Russians are the Soviets and Ukrainians and the West are the Nazi. And of course, seen from Ukraine, basically, you see their cities being bombed by the Russians in the way they have been bombed by the Nazis in the 1940s. But the most important is that they share the same type of a cultural memory of the World War II. And when you look at the Snake Island, and some of us that have been in school in the 1980s, one of the most famous Soviet films about the war is about the Fortress of Brest, where a kind of a small Soviet military unit has been defending this totally strategically unimportant place for weeks and weeks when the German troops have been almost in front of Moscow. But this idea that you're defending it in order to show your determination, it's not for the military purpose. So this is how you create identity. And when people said that President Putin created the modern identity of Ukraine, in a certain way, this is true. Many of these people were not very much sure what it means to be, but now they know very well. And for example, you see this on every level. We have a lot of colleagues now who are coming to Vienna in the Institute. One of my colleagues in the Institute, Timothy Snyder, is probably one of the leading experts on Ukraine and very much devoted to this place for a long time. And you're going to see that these people, they have a very, very strong identity. All of them speak as if they speak on behalf of Ukraine. All this was going to be impossible 10 years ago. And now the weak identity basically was the Russian identity. It's much more easy to understand now what it means to be Ukrainian than basically what it means to be Russian.
So let's go back to Russia then. And I know that in your book, The Light That Failed, you describe the political development in Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union. Yeah. And what are the most important things in this development that might explain Putin's Russia today? So if you could just take us through the main points.
The main point for me is basically we see these 30 years as something that is basically developing very much the same as if there is a major continuation. But it is not exactly the case. The most important thing that happened, and this is, by the way, the things that shaped very much, this is at the heart of the trauma of President Putin and his generation, is that they don't understand how the Soviet Union collapsed. They knew why the communism collapsed. By the way, many of these people, they are not people who are nostalgic for the communist period. And believe me, they like private property much more than some people are going to be surprised. As the saying goes, the people who govern Russia own Russia. But at the same time, they basically, because just to tell you how quickly, how history speed up so much that you really kind of lost the perspective when you were there what is happening. In December 1990, the Pentagon asked the top panel of the leading American experts on Soviet Union to judge what is the percent of the possibility for disintegration of the Soviet Union. Listen, these are people that have spent all their life studying Soviet Union. Some of them were as hawkish as you can imagine. 30%. 30% was what they believe was the real risk for Soviet Union to disintegrate. And they have, of course, a very important arguments for this. As one of the line of this report was, great powers often collapse, but they never commit a suicide. But the most important is they claim this is a nuclear power. So from this point of view, they cannot be simply defeated in a way you're going to defeat a normal military state. Secondly, economically, the Soviet Union was done in the way to make the disintegration very difficult, which means that if you're producing a car, auto, one elements are going to be produced in Georgia, another in Armenia, another basically in Russia. Everything was done in the way to keep the country together. So they believe that there are going to be major changes, but it is not going to happen. So when basically the disintegration of the Soviet Union started, and keep in mind, it started with the decision of the Russian Federation. We are not talking about the Baltic republics, which, by the way, West never recognized as being part of the Soviet Union. During the Cold War, I can imagine that it was the same for Norway. Diplomatically, these countries was never being treated as part of the Soviet Union, but as occupied territories. And then you have basically the in March 1991, in several of the Soviet republics, there was a referendum, do you want to keep Soviet Union together? And in most of these places, people said yes. But then come the coup, the August of 1991, being done by people who wanted to keep Soviet Union by force. And over a period of 2 or 3 months, everything changed. And the decision to disintegrate the Soviet Union was the decision of the Russian leadership. President Yeltsin decided that this is the only way basically to eliminate also Gorbachev of the power struggle. And then he went for the meeting with the Ukrainian president, Belarusian president, and the Kazakh president, because this was what for these people was Russia. And said, okay, let's make something different. We are not going to pay. And this was very important. And this is why some of the reform economists supported the disintegration. They said, we cannot go with a price reform if basically we cannot control who is using the ruble. And they said, we are not going to donate to the Central Asian republics. So then started this process of disintegration, and the Americans were very, very much kind of tense about what was going on. And the major kind of reasons what makes, and this was the administration, particularly in 1991 of Bush Sr., was that they were afraid of the nuclear proliferation. Because at this moment, several of the former Soviet republics has a big arsenal of nuclear weapons, and Ukraine was the third biggest in the world. And this is why for people in the White House, the idea was we cannot go like this. If these republics are going to keep their nuclear, and because they're kind of poor countries with a very weak institutions, they'll start to basically sell the nuclear technology, which means that in 10 years, we're going to end up with a proliferation in which you're going to have 20-25% of a nuclear states, and this is a different world. And to be honest, they were not totally wrong, because if you're going to ask how the Pakistanis make their bomb, there was a certain transfer of technologies coming from the former Soviet Union on a private level, not as a decision of the governments and others. So as a result of it, there was a major kind of a story behind it. And this is what didn't happen. What also did not happen was that in 1991, and this is, there are only two things, because in my view, this kind of a period so much disappeared. So this is why it's so difficult for us to see certain things in historical perspective. Do you remember that there was a war in the Middle East after Saddam Hussein decided to invade Kuwait? This was the time when President Bush for the first time used the phrase New World Order. But do you know how the New World Order looked like in 1991? That Soviets and Americans go together. They managed to create a coalition with most of the Arab states. They're liberating Kuwait, but the Americans decided not to do a regime change. And they allow basically Saddam to remain because they're afraid that if you're going to replace Saddam, this is going to be a kind of a gift to the Iranians, which was also kind. So this was the idea. And this idea was kind of a very much popular in the West, but it was not popular with the people in the East, because this type of a highly realist politics makes a very good dissertations, particularly if you're in the international relations. But people have their own idea what they want. And they go on the street and they have a, they need a state of their own, and basically they develop their own identities. And then comes the next moment when you go on the opinion polls and see when the Russian public opinion turns against the West. Of course, this was during the war in Kosovo. And this was the moment in which then Prime Minister of Russia, Viktor Chernomyrdin, was flying to the United States to meet the Vice President Al Gore, who was his counterpart. And when the plane was in the air, he was informed that NATO started a military operation on the territory of the former Yugoslavia without the decision of the Security Council and without the approval of the Russians. And basically then, Primakov asked his plane to return back to Moscow. This was when basically Bush Senior New World Order ended and something else happened. And ever since, the resentment towards the West was very much part of a certain type of a circles, because part of the Bush senior doctrine was Russia is weak, but we pretend that we're not seeing it. Because listen, in the 1990s, Russia was really kind of destroyed. One third of the economy, the GDP Russia lost one third of its economy lost one third in the 1990s. Just to compare, what is this? This is basically one third is how Ukraine has lost out of a year of a massive bombing and destruction. The life expectancy in Russia decreased by 5 years. There was a lot of social drama. And particularly in 1998, when the financial crisis destroyed the new middle class that started to emerge, it was big. So this was the moment in where I do believe the 1990s ended and the new Russia started to emerge. And when Putin came to power, he probably has not made also his mind what exactly he wanted. He was, by the way, the first international leader who supported the Americans after 9/11. Because he believed that anti-terrorist agenda is going to work for Russia. Russia was coming out of a second Chechen war, and he's going to be a very important military partner to the Americans. And then came the Iraqi war, and he believed that he's going to make a coalition with the Germans and French against the Americans. And he was doing this and that, and of course the price of oil was going up, and Russia started basically to be economically stronger, and they started for the first time to invest certain things in the Russian military. And 2007, you end up with the famous speech in Munich, which was de facto declaration that Russia see the international order as an enemy, that basically the only way for the Russia to prosper in the world is to destroy the Western land liberal order. And from this moment on, you have quite a lot of predictability. This is one of, and I'm going to end up on this. This is one of the interesting stories with Putin. We all the time try to guess what he had in mind. Particularly recently, after he stayed in power for so long, he should be taken literally. He's doing what he's saying that he will do. Because we know that he's coming from the intelligence services, we always try to see what is behind this. But listen, when for 20 years you're at the top of a big state, you don't have any reasons to have a second plan. Because the only person with whom you talk friendly is, of course, is God. And from this point of view, he was very much in this, and it was coming. You can see that first it was Georgia. Then basically came Crimea. Crimea had a very strong impact on Putin because of two reasons. 2011 was the major mass protest of the Russian middle class before the presidential elections, because during the Medvedev period, now when people are reading what Medvedev is saying, it is interesting to believe how many people were so much in love with him. And by the way, President Obama in 2011, when he was asked, what is your favorite foreign leader? He said, Medvedev. And he now behaves like an insane man. If you're reading basically his tweets, it's beyond, I mean, But the interesting story was that then the Russian middle class believed that they're going to be a Russian type of a soft authoritarianism, which is going to be much more competitive, and Putin is going to divorce Putinism from himself, and he probably even can allow Medvedev to stay for one more term, and there was all these talks. I remember being in the United States back then, and people were saying, so who is going to be Putin or Medvedev? And coming from where you're coming from, Eastern Europe, my answer was, listen, of course there are two camps in Russia. There is a Putin and Medvedev camp, but we don't know to which Medvedev belongs. Because people has invented Medvedev as an alternative, which he never was. And as a result of it, suddenly Putin saw on the streets people who benefited most from this kind of a reforms and economy. This was the middle class people who wanted more independence and who felt humiliated that these two guys drinking beer like us decided who is going to be the next president. Because this is what happened. They were agreeing. And then this was a moment of crisis. And people who have been seeing Putin in 2012 speaking basically to his own people when the workers came from the countryside and this was the real people and the middle class were not. You know that there was something was changing, not simply in the nature of the regime, but in the way he was seeing all this. And then came Crimea. And I was in Moscow 10 days after the annexation of Crimea. And the level of enthusiasm was
enormous.
And to be honest, it was genuine. And you were shocked to see to what extent basically all different types of people, people that you never expected to be interested in this or doing this, it is ours. Crimea is ours. I do believe this is the moment in which he decided to stay in history as somebody who is going to unify the Russian lands. And then the problem when it's going to be the war was a technical problem. When he's going to be ready, when he believes how the Americans are going to react, what he expects from Europeans. But I do believe it was this first weeks after the annexation of Crimea that basically created Russia in the way we see it now.
So what have all this that you've now described has influenced on the other Eastern European countries, all the countries down the line, all through down to Bulgaria? And you can just see what they are doing now when they are confronted with the invasion of Russia in Ukraine and what the development you see for them.
Listen, Eastern Europe is not as unified when it comes to Russia as basically looks in the newspaper articles for several reasons. First, you have countries that have been very much occupied by Russia. And even now, I have been part of some opinion polling after the beginning of the war. If you see what West Europeans fear and what East Europeans fear, you're going to see in places like Poland and Baltics, people fear occupation in the ways they fear nuclear war. The most important divide, of course, is between Baltic republics and Poland, for which it's just existential. This is their war. It's not about Ukraine. It's about them. Then you have the problem with countries like Bulgaria. Serbia is a very special case because of the Yugoslav story is the following. Bulgarian nationalism was always anti-Turkish and not anti-Russian because basically Bulgaria come as a result of the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire. And this was the interesting story about Europe. People like to say that Europe was created by nation states and so on. But Europe was not, European Union was not created by nation states. European Union, when it was created by former and acting empires, all of them with the exception of the Luxembourg. Which means that they have a different idea of diversity of part of the world. I'm saying this not in a value term, but it was simply different type of states. To the extent that President de Gaulle believed that under certain conditions, European Union can be the collective owner of the French colonial possessions back then. The first time a kind of a nation states born out of the disintegration of the empires entered the European Union with Greece, Ireland, but Eastern Europe. And these Europeans have a totally different idea about the empire. In a certain way, they have a very strong things that you can see in the post-colonial world. And the empire they have been fighting for, most of them have been the Russian Empire. And as a result of it, now when it started, basically they were seeing this very much as a kind of attempt of recolonization. And this is they're reacting like this. Czech Republic, Slovakia, all of them also have their own histories. And in the case of Hungary, it was much more the decision of the Hungarian government that shaped the position because there is no particular historical reasons for Hungary to be where it was. But as a result of this war, the Visegrad Four does not exist anymore. It's 2+1+1. Czech Republic and Slovakia staying together. Poland on one side, Hungary on totally different side. So, strangely enough, the war much more consolidated Europe as a whole than Eastern Europe as a whole. And here Kundera has an important statement. He said that in order to understand all the small East European countries, and Poland is not too small, is that you should try to understand that they never take the existence of their state for granted. Because historically, all of these countries have been losing their sovereignty and their statehood. And he's giving this absolutely brilliant example. He said, you know, the Polish anthem has a line, Polish has not perished yet. He said, can you imagine this in the German or French or British anthem? No. And I do believe this kind of a different sensitivity was very much provoked and very much kind of opened. So Europeans can think together about the future, so you can kind of talk about the future. But when it comes to past, nightmares are always national.
So then what is Germany's nightmare then? If we bring it up to what's happening in the other European countries, then we can go to the United States afterwards. But Germany seems to be in the midst of a paradigm shift, and it's kind of what can we expect from Germany in the future, in the near future, in this conflict?
Listen, if you read basically, for Germany, this is an identity crisis. And I do believe one of the things that we should be very much kind of patient with is to try to understand that this war is basically trying to unlearn Germans. Unlearn Germans to believe everything that they believe was right. For example, we're now joking and saying how they can believe that economic interdependence is enough for security. But this was the success of Germany. And the major lessons in political terms, which if you're talking to your German politicians, what they learned after the end of the World War II and basically the emergence of new post-war Germany was two things, never again and never alone. And never again is very important. And this is very strong generationally. I do believe that Germany should have given thanks to Ukraine earlier, for reasons that we can discuss. But I don't feel happy when I see people, particularly in some of our countries, believing that this is just because the Germans has a commercial interest. It's much more deeper. Listen, there was a whole generation who believed that they don't want to see German tanks on the territory of the former Soviet Union. Full stop. And this is serious. And some of these are very decent people. So part of the story is it's not an easy decision. Germans has managed to convince themselves that military power does not matter. And now you understand that it matters. And you understand that Germany basically should really, if they want to play the role that they should play in the European Union, they should basically dramatically change their defense capabilities. But imagine what it means for a social democratic chancellor in a coalition with the Greens to ask for 100 billion military budget. Do you remember that one of the things that was central for the Greens when they came to power was that Germany should not sell weapons to the conflicts around the world? So this is an identity change for Germany. And of course, Germany had to change, and it was very much pushed. But more than any other country, Germany basically found itself in the world they believed that never going to find themselves in. And this is why I have kind of a disagreements with the way I do believe that the pace of decision-making was difficult and so on, and it was clearly obvious that Germany has no reasons to believe of escalation, because when the massive bombing of the Ukrainian city started, Russians escalated to the extent that there is no, the only other escalations about nuclear, it has nothing to do with the German tanks. But this is very important to have a patience to understand the cultural choices that people were facing. And on this, to be honest, East Europeans were not great, because Germans has one particular distinction. They like lecturing people. There was this famous joke that if you go basically to heaven, and when basically the bus to heaven stops, there are two roads, one to heaven and one lectures on heaven. And the Germans always go for the lectures. So from this point of view, of course they have this, but now many of East Europeans we basically use for the last 1 year to lecture back. Not understanding that for the Germans it was not easy. And so when you're telling me how it's going to work, I don't know. But obviously, German society is changing. By the way, there is a major generation change. And to imagine now the most kind of supportive for giving weapons at the leadership of the Green Party. And by the way, Habeck did it even before the war started, saying we should do this. This is something to understand how much Germany and Europe has been changed.
Well, if we just turn to the United States then, and I'll ask you... this is actually from Jeff Gedmin that you know. Yeah. What is the new normal and what can we expect from the United States? Because we know that they have been hugely important so far in this conflict for Ukrainians. And there's an election coming, obviously too soon. I saw that Trump was leading the polls for the Republicans today, but we could leave it at that.
Listen, I'm in a classical position of a Bulgarian. When you come from Bulgaria, after doing Germany, I'm going to do the United States and I can do Mars and Moon next, because from small countries, we have a view on everything. But United States is a dramatically divided society. So much that for both sides, the most important war is the electoral war inside. And this is the biggest issue. So when you go on the opinion polls, you're going to see that I never bought, to be honest, the fact that Trump is a Russian agent of influence. Listen, President Trump is so much about himself that he cannot be the agent of anybody. No, he's not recruitable, let's put it like this. But the story is different, that because of this level of confrontation, which is very existential for both sides, it's about what it means to be an American, elections in America started to look basically one party or the other winning like a regime change. Europeans, of course, could have different preferences for one or the other party in the United States during the Cold War, but they knew that the American foreign policy is not going to change much. Now you cannot be sure in this anymore. Even if you see now in the electoral, in the opinion polls, you're going to see while that support for Ukraine is still very much there, the more the campaign is going to develop, the more the war is going to be perceived as the Biden's war. And the more basically Republicans are going to focus on China and saying that the United States is soft on China. And basically, if they come, China is the real issue. This doesn't come out of any sympathy for Putin. I don't know about Trump, but the Republicans in general, this is not what is about them. But this is about Biden. And for Biden himself, fighting Putin in a way in Ukraine is also fighting Trump. And this kind of a divide creates a very difficult situation. And if you're going to have a new Republican administration, this is not going to be back to the Trump administration, because Trump administration was a transition administration. So in a certain way, when you look to the people that have been particularly in the Pentagon, this was a kind of a classical post-Cold War consensus general, be General Mattis, be others. So from this point of view, these people, even when President Trump is going to make a statement here and there, they was following a much more bipartisan politics. And most of these people now easily can be seen also doing things for President Biden. If they're going to be a new Republican administration led by Donald Trump, it is going to be a different administration. Because the most important enemy for the Republicans now is the deep state. It's not so much Biden anymore. This is exactly people like Mattis and others who basically have been the state. What it means for the war? Listen, it's difficult. And I do believe President Zelensky was very smart to go on the last day of the Congress in order to show that there is a bipartisan support. But he knows very much that this bipartisan support is not as solid as it looks. Is it easy for the Americans to change position on 180 degrees? No. But one of the things that is going to happen for Europe dramatically is Europeans at the moment are working very easily with the Americans. is not going to be like this. Secondly, what President Trump is going to say, because he likes to say it, is that America is not going to pay the bill anymore. Because you can see that most of the money that have been spent, particularly for the military deliveries and others, are coming from the United States. So the cost of the war is going to be different. And I'm saying this because if you see the military strategy of the Russian Federation, one of them is very much to increase the cost of the war. I'm not a military man at all. But reading people who know what they're writing about, for example, you're going to see some strange things. For example, you see a house somewhere in Ukraine being hit by a missile that is normally used to hit the ship. Why it is done? Because the Russian missiles are quite cheap. They're using quite of old missiles. Well, the Ukrainians, in order basically to hit their missiles, is using these very expensive missiles that they are now getting from the West. So I was seeing one of the calculations, around $40,000 was one of these old Soviet missiles that the Russians are using, and it was destroyed in the air with the American missile, which basically cost $3 million. So trying to increase the cost of the war in order to make the West unwilling to pay is part of the Russia strategy. And this is why the question for whom the time work is such an important question.
That's what I was going to finish with before we do the Q&A, because Putin might speculate on these things and also on holding out until the elections, election in the United States. So what if they do and Russia succeed in Ukraine, or if the other way around, Ukraine survive, and what will Ukraine become if it survives as a national, as a state, a sovereign state? So the two possibilities. Or maybe there's something in between. Maybe it's just going on and on and on. And that's that we don't know. Something in between. What might that be?
Listen, probably it's going to be something between, but it's very important where the between is.
Yeah.
Particularly if you're Ukrainian. I don't believe that the Russian army is going to end up to go to the Polish border. But the story is that this level of destruction creates several problems. For example, one of the major problems for Ukraine from a prolonged war is that all these people who left the country have no way to come back. And listen, imagine that, and we see this very much in Vienna, this is a highly patriotic people. In a way, from time to time, this is really just like in a film, what you're seeing. This young woman with two kids staying in Vienna and insisting that the only thing that they want is to go back, and some of them coming from the places where there is no back, because they are cities which are totally destroyed. Mariupol is just totally destroyed. There is nothing. But these people, if they're going, if you're going to have a war that goes for 2-3 years, if the kids decide to go to school, if they start to like the school, the chance to come back is going to decrease, and we know very well from previous conflicts. Almost 60% of the Bosnians today live outside of Bosnia. And one of the biggest problems for any reconstruction is depopulation. You need people, by the way, particularly you need young people. And this is why it's so important, and I do believe this is so important also, and this is why Zelensky is so much trying to keep the level of mobilization so high. Can basically the Russians go for Kyiv? I don't know. Probably he can try. Still, what we are reading from the Western military sources, the chances to succeed probably is not great. But listen, it's a war. And we did, because in the beginning, we believed that Russian army, when I mean we, I mean the expert community everywhere, including in the United States, believed that the Russian army is much more effective. The idea that basically they're going to take over Kyiv in 3-4 weeks was a commonplace for many people that basically are making their living out of this. And then the Ukrainians did well, and then basically has the very important counteroffensive from the summer and the autumn. And then we went to the other extreme. We start talking about the Russian army as a kind of a cartoon. Listen, this is a cartoon of hundreds of thousands of soldiers. And of course, their logistics is not great. And obviously, what you see basically is doing, but this is a lot of people. And we are talking about a country which is 4 times bigger than Ukraine. And there is no Western troops in Ukraine. So from this point of view, this is going to be very tough. If you're asking about my personal view, I believe that we're going to end up something that very much resembles the Korean war where basically you end up with a conflict, which is no peace treaty. I cannot imagine how Ukraine is going to agree, any type of Ukraine, lawfully to go to Russia. But I can imagine that basically, and I know that also for the Russians, Crimea is really one of the very few places where the risk of tactical nuclear is real if the Russians are going to be basically get out of Crimea. But it is going to be very tough because this is going to be a ceasefire that can look for a peace, but for how long? And if you see how much time basically this phrasing in Korea turn out and how much also involvement on the side, particularly of the Americans and presence and so on. For Europe, it is very, very difficult. And where is going to be this freezing of the conflict? Where? I can imagine that, of course, it's one thing if it's going to freeze on the line on which the Russians have been on February 24. It's totally different if it is going to be on the positions which are now. This is part of the story. So even when you're telling me how it's going to end, it's so difficult. It's so difficult to imagine. And this is also so difficult to imagine exactly because we are democracies. We have been discussing this. You have elections in Russia in 2024 and you have elections in Ukraine. If President Zelensky, for some reasons, which I don't see, decides to make a compromise, do you believe that there are not going to be a candidate against him who is going to say, you promised to the people that we are not going to give up our land? On the other side, people believe that President Putin can do anything he wants. This is not what he believes. There are constraints in every political system. Very different in a democracy and not democracy. But for the first time, President Putin fears much more the nationalistic wing of his elite than the Western liberal one, because almost 500,000 people left Russia for political reasons since the beginning of the war. And I was quoting a study that was done by three Russian colleagues of mine who shows that the impact of this, seeing the profile of the people that have left, is comparable to the impact of the exile of the white Russians after the Bolshevik revolutions. We're talking about highly educated people coming from a very technologically advanced sectors of the economy, basically IT, financial, and others. Listen, this is an exodus that for any country is very difficult to replace. You can replace glasses. The most difficult to replace is people. And a lot of money have been put in the education of these people. By the way, Russia has developed for the last 20 years several very competitive universities. These universities are over. Their best professors left. The level of academic freedom is zero. If students go on the streets, the professors are going to be politically responsible why the students are on the street. And they were good universities. I know that High School of Economics was a great place. Not anymore. Mm-hmm.
Just to end, I just have to add one more question and I'll open it for the floor. So if you have questions, you can prepare them and I'll try to get the microphone around. But I just wanted to ask you, what is, apart from what you just described about Putin and Russia, what is his weakest point?
Do you know, his weakest point is that he's mortal.
Well,
but this is very important because in a certain way, he's mortal because you have a political system which is very much focused on one personality. He didn't manage to create a system. And this is very different from the Soviet times. In the Soviet times, there was a mechanism what happens when the guy is not there anymore. The Politburo is going to meet. They're going to decide. There is a party. The Chinese are doing this. You know also what is happening in a democracy. There are elections. You know what is happening in a monarchy. Though the sun. But what is going to happen in Russia? This is the problem. There is one person whose source of legitimacy of the system goes to him. And as a result of it, he creates the biggest problem for the system because nobody can talk about post-Putin Russia. People around Putin are as nervous about what is going to happen than basically opponents of Putin because this conversation is not taking place. Because in a certain way, the institutional of succession does not exist in the current regime. If they're going to, we don't know who is the Politburo. Imagine the President Putin and decides to retire, and he goes somewhere. who is going to decide who is the next leader? Do we know? Is that the legitimate mechanism? Who is going to be? And then, of course, the elections. Can they organize a competitive elections, free elections, after all this that was happening all this year? And this is very important. In the book with Stephen Holmes, we're making, and this last point, something that is very important. People never understand how important elections were in the Russian system before the war became the major source of legitimacy. Because the biggest question to understand the Putin system is to ask a very simple question. Why in 2004 he didn't allow competitive elections which he was going to win? Everybody, even his biggest opponents, believed that in 2004, if there was a competitive elections, he was going to win them. Why you rigged elections that you can win honestly? And the most important is because the elections is about something different. The role of the elections is to show that you do not have an alternative. And this is why basically you're coming and the elections is just showing how the others are nobodies. And he was selecting the same people, and as you can imagine, not the most impressive ones. And this is why basically when Navalny was allowed to run for the mayor of Moscow and suddenly he gets his 20%, he was not going to allow to run anywhere else, because basically all the idea of the elections is to tell to the people there is no alternative. But now when he's not there, what this there is no alternative means. And I do believe this is the problem of this type of a charismatic regimes which does not have a clear ideology. And when you're saying what is the problem, Putin is the problem. And this problem for the Putin is not only problem for those who does not like him.
Okay, we are not ending on this note, but thank you for these answers, Ivan.
If you like Liberal Halvtime, rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage, www.civita.no. Ivan Krastev's books are available in bookstores. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.